You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
In the 60s and 70s, when the United States was in the midst of a Cold War, if you had an adversary like the Soviet Union that disabled that central hub, you had no communication.
Why the infrastructure of the internet is what we need to revamp.
They took it off the track it was going, a decentralized track, and put it onto a very centralized track. And the app era did something that the inventors, the creators of TCP/IP didn't intend, the creator of HTTP didn't intend, and that was where a few companies completely dominate the landscape.
People don't understand that that's what's happening.
It's the way that the internet is now being used and the way it's been co-opted by these big platforms, it's actually causing problems in the world.
But I think the reason is, for the longest time, people weren't aware that they were giving their data, or maybe they were just apathetic towards it. I don't know.
So we have this beautiful, beautiful technology that was created by really smart people to help us all, and it's been co-opted in a way that is now harming us, including young, innocent people. So, and it's not just where you buy a pair of shoes or something. It is everything about us.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. HubSpot is a huge supporter of the show. I'm a huge fan of HubSpot, not just because they support the show, because they support entrepreneurs. And if you are an entrepreneur, you have some problems that a lot of entrepreneurs have: productivity. And it's not a secret. It's nothing to be ashamed of. You're not the only one that has this problem. And why do we have this problem? Well, all the tools and the tech that we're using, they're massively overcomplicated. We have tons of time-consuming tasks. Our teams are not getting the information they need to close the deals, connect with customers, whatever it is. As entrepreneurs and our teams, we all have productivity problems, but HubSpot's customer platform truly helps. It was built to save time and make your job easier, so you can get back to building your business. No more hours wasted on time-consuming tasks. No more chasing down prospect info if you're trying to close someone. No more one system for this, another system for that. HubSpot can help you find leads, reach prospects, deliver the insights you need to convert them to customers, all in one place. Plus, HubSpot AI can literally do more work for you, so you can focus more on scaling your business, because HubSpot knows you have massive growth goals and they're here to make your productivity problem go away. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better. Frank, thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be with you. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to dive into the mind of somebody that is trying to disrupt, because I love entrepreneurs. I love when entrepreneurs disrupt. You are a fifth generation builder, but you are an entrepreneur at heart. And I think that to solve any problem, you have to throw an entrepreneur at it. That's the best way to solve problems. So when you look at, we're going to talk about the internet. We're going to talk about all the problems with the internet. When you look at the problems with the internet, you look at it, and not just internet, privacy, big tech, through the eyes of an entrepreneur, you've chosen to focus on infrastructure as a core thesis as to what we have to solve for. So maybe explain to me why the infrastructure of the internet is what we need to revamp.
How deep do you want to go?
Let's go deep. Okay. It's a smart audience. Let's go all deep.
Right. Okay. So let's go deep. So, let's start in the 60s and 70s when the United States was in the midst of a Cold War and was very concerned with centralized telecommunications. We had communications that was hardwired, went through central hubs to redirect communication. So theoretically, if you had an adversary like the Soviet Union that disabled that central hub, you had no communication. Big problem. So the government set out to say, how do we build a decentralized communication system? More of a spider web. If you poke a hole in it, you can still get around it and still have a and still connect to the other end. So that was the beginning. And in 1983, there were two protocols that a bunch of researchers agreed to adopt to connect their devices. One was called the Transfer Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, TCP/IP. I call it one protocol now, TCP/IP, but
the
it was
trans- the one.
It's actually two protocols that are co-joined. And when these devices were connected, suddenly, boom, we had the internet, right? And the internet was intended to connect computing devices that adopted these protocols, and we were up and running. Now let's stop for a second, and just as a footnote, IP, Internet Protocol. We are still an IP address on the internet, right? We are not a person on the internet. We're a device. Okay, now roll the clock forward. 1989, Tim Berners-Lee comes around, says, I have another idea. Also another protocol. And by the way, when I say protocols, I'm talking core internet protocols, super thin layer. Very powerful because they're at the bottom of the stack, but very thin at the same time. So he comes forward with something called the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTTP, and that connects data. So now you have devices connected, and you have data links. And then, so we have the World Wide Web. And that's, you know, both were intended to be highly decentralized. So the World Wide Web, just like the earlier solution for a decentralized communication system, the World Wide Web was a decentralized internet so that we could really empower individuals, share knowledge, do great stuff, and it would be the proverbial tide that lifted all human boats, right? And that was all wonderful, and it's awesome, and so on and so forth. What happened about 15 years later was that companies, platforms, discovered that if they could aggregate all this data that was now up for grabs, centralize it, collect it, you know, and just apply algorithms to this massive data that they had collected, they could they'd kind of be the big dogs, right, in the on the internet. And we all as users weren't necessarily educated about, okay, what does this all mean? And we kind of went along with it. And I think with a societal enthusiasm that this internet is a very cool thing. It connects us all, must be good. And so we all went along for the next phase of the internet, which was the app era. And the app era did something that the inventors, you know, the creators of TCP/IP didn't intend, the creator of HTTP didn't intend, and that was they took it off the track it was going, a decentralized track, and put it onto a very centralized track. And now we had a very centralized internet where a few companies, as we've learned over the last 20 years, have completely dominated the landscape. These companies own us, right? Because they also discovered that the really valuable part of the data is something called our social graph. And that is everything about us. So, and it's not just where you buy a pair of shoes or something. It is everything about us. Yes, it includes where we buy things and where we physically are and what we search for and who we communicate with, but it's also now how we think, what we're going to react to, how we behave. Mm-hmm. It's very predictive now, right?
There's so many data points.
Yeah, we are the sum of our data points.
Yeah.
It's a massive collection of data. And so now these machines, remember, it was built to connect machines, right? It know more about us than we know about ourselves. So that's why it feels so weird now and strange, because we've been disconnected from our real us. And so somehow this all evolved where, you know, we were kind of led to believe, or maybe naively moved forward, with technology, thinking like our digital selves is different than our biological selves. But in the world we live in today, our digital self is the same, is one and the same with our biological self, in the sense that it's part of our identity, right? You can't separate yourself from your biological DNA. Well, you can't separate yourself from your digital DNA, your lived experience. So that's what's really causing so many problems now, is that we're kind of losing our identity, our citizenship, our relationships, kind of what all the stuff that makes us human is kind of been scraped from us and sucked out of us. So we have an internet now that's highly dehumanizing, kind of soulless, and controlled, run by algorithms, machines, etc., fueled by all this data, and more specifically our social graphs, all of the stuff that makes us us. And we're being dragged now into a future that feels, you know, uncomfortable. And that's why you feel kind of an unease. We're seeing the harms. We're not governable anymore. Why? Because the algorithms are designing us to be at odds all the time, 50% here, 50% there. And, you know, we see the information ecosystem or landscape totally corrupted. And of course, most importantly, we're harming children.
So I think that if you ask anybody if they're happy about the internet and the way that it's evolved, I don't think many people are. I think that there's the casual, oh, I feel like my phone's listening to me, all the way through to, you know, the reasons why, like GDPR and CCPA and Cambridge Analytica came to be. I am curious, because I want to go just briefly back into your story a little bit. Why did you choose to make this your fight?
Well, you mentioned earlier that I'm a fifth generation builder.
Yes.
So I'm hardwired that way. Right. And I grew up in a household with, I'm one of seven kids, and, you know, parents that, you know, I think raised us to be active citizens and really engaged. And when me and my brothers and sisters would sit at a dinner table and start complaining about things, you know, which we were pretty good at, you know, the dinner wouldn't end without my mom saying, okay, you guys have identified the problem. Now, what are you going to do about it? And so that all that part is kind of hardwired in me. And then, you know, I if you just really move the clock back to the last decade or so, I started a public policy school at Georgetown University, with Georgetown University. And, you know, in October of 2013, and we, of course, knew that massive data was important. And so we put a massive data institute inside of the school. And, you know, figuring, in retrospect, it was rather naive that, okay, we're going to have this massive data institute. Policymakers need big data to make good decisions. And so off we went. And it didn't take 2 or 3 years to learn that it's not going to work. I mean, the school's awesome, don't get me wrong. But this idea that, you know, we have what's publicly available data is going to help policymakers isn't going to work. Because what's really valuable is the data that sits in the server farms of these big platforms. And here, and I'll share one story with you. One of the faculty members told me she had a theory that you could predict large-scale human physical migration by seeing what words are amplified on social media. It's pretty cool, right? I mean, and so she got a grant from the government of $200,000. To actually sharpen that model. And she knew Twitter had the data she needed to sharpen the model. So she went to them and said, do you have the data? And they said, yes. And she said, can I have it? And they said, for $100,000. And she said, I can't give you half my grant because I don't have the data, but we'll be able to do the work, right? And they said, well, you can't have the data then. So let's think about this for a second. The most vulnerable human beings in the world, they're leaving where they live because they can't. It's not sustainable for them anymore, and they have to uproot and go. They've created this data. An academic who's not going to commercialize it wants to help us all by developing a model that will help humanitarian organizations and governments to know when something, you know, very, very big.
A crisis.
A crisis is going to happen. And she can't have the data unless she pays money for it. So whose data is this? I would say it's the people who created the data. And for sure, we would want that data to help them. And all of us have better models to be able to help people, right? But no, these big platforms say it's their data. So and what we really...
If you ask those people, they would give you the data too.
Yeah.
If you asked every single individual.
Totally. If people knew, if we had trust and confidence in the internet again, people will share all kinds of things if they know it's for what purpose it's being used and there's transparency. And by the way, if there's economic benefit, they get some of that. And right now it's upside down because the data is there for us to solve lots of big problems in the world. However, it's the way that the internet is now being used and the way it's been co-opted by these big platforms, it's actually causing problems in the world. So, you know, I mentioned, you know, the difficulty we're having in sustaining democracies around the world, and including here in the U.S., the inability to tell fact from fiction. You can't, you know, the deep fakes are so good. Anybody can say, it's not me. I didn't say that. What, you know, whatever. How do you actually get to the bottom of these things? Our ability to know what is a fact and versus what is fiction, it's been degraded. And again, and I know we'll talk about this later, the harms to children is unconscionable. You know, if I said to you, I'm the head of the Postal Service and I have an idea, a deal for you, I'll deliver your mail for free, no more stamps. You'd probably say, well, I guess that's better than paying stamps. You might be a bit suspicious, but you'd say, tell me, what's the deal? Well, I'm going to put cameras in every room of your house and in your car and in your office and surveil you 24 hours a day. You would do exactly what you just did. You'd laugh, right? Now I'd say, well, but it's for free. It's for free. And then, oh, one other thing. I'm going to open the mail. I'm going to read it, and whatever I read and learn is now mine, okay? Your relationships are now my relationships. Your ideas are now my ideas, et cetera, et cetera. Now you'd be like, this is really ridiculous.
This is happening.
Okay. But I'd say, I need to tell you. You know your 13-year-old daughter who keeps a diary? Well, I read that diary too. And when I see that she's maybe worried about her weight or worried about something, as all 13-year-olds are, I get to actually prey on her, on that vulnerability and that insecurity, to make money. It's sick. It's just not correct. And so we have this beautiful, beautiful technology that was created by really smart people to help us all, and it's been co-opted in a way that it's now harming us, really harming us, including young, innocent people. And that's why you see, you know, the a whole generation more anxious, more depressed, thoughts of suicide, and sadly, actual suicides. So enough is enough. This is an engineering problem, and I say that from a engineering perspective, right? We can fix this by adding yet another thin layer protocol that for the first time puts us in charge of us on the internet. So I own me again. And my social graph, you own you again in your social graph. And now apps will be built. Rather than us clicking on them and giving everything away, they'll actually click on our terms of use for our data. And we'll have to be a person to be on the internet. And our data will be portable and the apps will be interoperable and so on and so forth. It will be a better version of the internet, and all of the TCP/IP will still work, HTTP will still work, but we'll have another protocol, we call it DSNP, which will put us in charge of us, and we will own us again. Agency will be returned to us, choice, permission, autonomy, liberty, right? And this is what we crave for as human beings, and why in the earth we would give that up just to use the internet is beyond my comprehension.
So that's a really good question. And I think that I want to maybe ask you why that is, because the example you just gave of the person, the postman coming to your house and saying, I'm going to deliver your mail for free and install cameras and not charge you anymore. And then I'm going to look at your daughter's diary and exploit her. It's because people don't understand that that's what's happening. People aren't aware, or maybe they are becoming aware. I don't know. You're so involved in this world right now that maybe you see people waking up. But I think the reason is, for the longest time, people weren't aware that they were giving their data, or maybe they were just apathetic towards it. I don't know. But how do you, Project Liberty, how do you plan to galvanize people, move them away from this entrenched big tech entity, all these different companies? Because I know you can do it. I know you can disrupt, and that's doable. It's not easy. But what's the playbook?
Yeah, so the reason I wrote Our Biggest Fight, is to really shine light on Project Liberty and this idea of reimagining really how the internet works. And, you know, I've committed $500 million to the effort, but it's not my biggest fight. It's our biggest fight. So it's going to take a lot more than that, and a lot more than than me, and so on and so forth. And we have great people now in Project Liberty, and many, many of them working really hard on this. And the playbook looks like this. You start by fixing the tech, because if we don't fix the tech, we're not going to fix any of these problems for the reasons I just outlined. So we need to get ourselves back in charge of our social graphs, of our personal data. And by the way, I really, maybe let's not even call it data anymore in this conversation. Let's call it our personhood, right?
It humanizes it.
And it's who we are.
Yeah.
It's who we are. So how do we get retake control of our personhood away from the machines and algorithms of big tech? So that's the goal of Project Liberty on the tech side. So we have a bunch of brilliant people who have came up with the idea of a protocol to create universally accessible global social graph. So rather than billions of atomized social graphs that these platforms vacuum up and then do what they do with it, with that data, why not one giant pool of growing data? It grows every day massively because we're all connected to the internet. All this information, all this stuff, what if it's kind of just all of ours, right? And, or nobody's, depending on how you want to look at it, but it's certainly not five companies. And then we have ownership and control of our social graph. So we decide who gets to, who we share what with on what terms. So that's the tech piece of this. However, our theory of change is that you can't solve the issues just by having technologists, once again, try to predict what's good for society. You need society to decide what's good for society. We need this time around to bring in social scientists, the policy and governance experts, the economists, the psychologists, the people that understand human behavior. We need to bring in artists and people that really understand what culture is and how to modify culture. We need to bring in teachers, parents, people. We need people to be here. So that's what differentiates this project, is that we're coming forward not just throwing more logs on the fire of what's wrong. We're saying, and we're grateful to those that are talking about what's wrong, because it's important that people be awakened here. We're bringing forward a solution. And by the way, if there's a better solution, we're going to support it. We're not putting forward a product. This is a solution to a big problem that I would argue is the biggest problem of our day.
It's a movement. It's an ideology.
And then bring in people who can help make sure that the next generation of the internet is designed with people in mind, and that takes some expertise. But also, let's engage, as you say, people, and make this a movement. This is like our man on the moon moment, right? This is what I believe we need right now, because we're kind of recycling around this, kind of uneasy, kind of hollow, we're kind of being manipulated. And it just doesn't feel like, a lot of people saying like, what's my purpose? What do I want to do? Well, here's a purpose. Let's fix this. let's fix this. Can you, wouldn't it be great that if, rather than polling young people and asking them, will your life be better than your parents, and have a majority of them say, no, I'm pretty down on things. What if we polled them and 90% of them said, my life is going to be way better than my parents because I'm going to live till I'm 150 and I'm going to live a healthy life because we've used all of this technology to achieve that, rather than technology that preys on young kids and preys on all of us, right? And is very exploitive and very surveillance oriented. It's just, we have the wrong design. It's, the internet is not bad. The internet is awesome. Technology is awesome. How it's designed and being used, however, is very, very bad for individuals and society. And so let's fix the design, and let's also bring in, let's add the social scientists to the computer scientists, and let's bring in, let's get this conversation to the kitchen table. Let's get it to the sidelines of the soccer pitch. Let's get it to into schools, including grammar schools, right, and high schools, and where this is really, really doing a lot of damage. Let's get this on, you know, outside churches and whatever other places people hang around and do fun stuff or serious stuff. But let's get a conversation going.
I just want to take a second and thank the HubSpot Podcast Network for supporting Success Story. We're part of the network. If you love podcasts, the Hub.
Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free. Eufy is sponsoring today's video. They reached out to me. I tested out their video lock. It is a game changer. I'm going to paint a picture for you for why I'm so excited to work with them. So, you're getting home, your arms are loaded with groceries or packages or boxes or everything, and your keys are in your pocket. This drives me nuts. This happens all the time. I upgraded to the Eufy Video Lock. Fingerprint, tap, I'm inside. And honestly, I also feel way safer. It's got this awesome built-in camera, so whether it's a package delivery or late night Uber order, I see exactly who's there right from my phone. There are no more mystery knocks. And the best part, this thing was such a breeze to set up. There's no wires. There's no drilling. There's also no monthly subscription fees. So if you are done fumbling with your keys, because I definitely am, search for Eufy Video Lock or head over to eufyofficial.com/video lock. Your front door, your sanity. I just want to take a second and thank Policy Genius. They're supporting today's episode of Success Story. I know we all have kids. We all have families we want to take care of. And I personally checked something off major on my to-do list. Life insurance. It's a tough topic. It's really hard to think about, but it's so important. And the hard part was sorting through all the options. Luckily, I found Policy Genius. Policy Genius is an online insurance marketplace that makes getting life insurance surprisingly easy. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Now, knowing my family's protected brings me incredible peace of mind. Don't put off this important decision. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
Spot Podcast Network has other incredible podcasts like Entrepreneurs on Fire, hosted by John Lee Dumas. Entrepreneurs on Fire is one of the OG entrepreneur podcasts. It really stokes inspiration, shares strategies to fire up your entrepreneurial journey to create the life you've always dreamed of. It has unlimited energy, value, and consistency. The podcast is truly for anyone who wants to learn more about entrepreneurship. If you like fast-paced, packed with value stories. This show is for you. John brings on great guests. He speaks about failures, aha moments, what's working for them currently. If you love podcasts, go listen to Entrepreneurs on Fire wherever you get your podcasts. When you look at
this problem, it starts to look like a human rights problem because you're giving up all these liberties, like you mentioned before. Talk to me about the government's role, about Congress, about regulatory, because you see, CCPA, GDPR, I don't think that even after those mandates, maybe the iOS update where people have a harder time targeting customers when they're running ads, there's like little things that are trying to protect people, but you're talking about a whole revamp. So does the government have a role to play in this, or is it not moving fast enough? You got to galvanize the people, or is it like a two-part solution to the problem?
Well, let's, again, if the politicians were doing the job to fix this, you and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation. So I wrote the book as a call to action, because if the CEOs, the first stop is the CEOs of these companies, who we now know that their algorithms are doing harm. So you kind of think when people know they're doing harm, they would change something. And you've all seen the testimony in Congress with these CEOs, and it's like theater, right? It's like, oh, I can't believe this stuff is really going on. This is horrible. And then nothing happens, right? So the CEO is not going to do anything. And then the next stop would, in the normal world, the one I grew up in, right, pre-internet, would be you go to the politicians and you say, like we do with tobacco, it's killing people. Like, let's get some regulation in place. But like I said, nothing's happening. And why? Is it because they're not educated on the tech and don't understand how it works? Maybe. Is it because they're taking a lot of money from these richest companies ever created? By the way, and I say that as a capitalist, I'm all for people making money, but not if it's going to destroy society, right? And maybe they're taking money, but I think for sure they're using this technology to get elected and to raise money and get votes and get clicks and get likes and get the same thing.
So the incentives are wrong.
They're in the same loop.
Yeah.
They're in the same loop where the irony is we're talking about fixing a problem that's the very problem that's causing them to continue to recycle, and they're using the technology and it's further and further polarizing them and making our political system more, less and less functional and more paralyzed. So the same political apparatus that we want to fix the problem normally is also being manipulated by this, because the algorithms are designed to polarize us. Have you ever wondered why everything seems like there's 50% of people on one side and 50% on one?
And also why everybody online seems to echo the exact same view that you have?
Yeah, so this is all the design. And this is algorithms doing a perfect job. It's perfectly tweaked algorithms to keep us in a constantly 50-50 state, constantly triggered, constantly, half, because that keeps us, engaged and having to defend ourselves and this. And that. So it's, and believing we're totally right, right? And whereas the other person has exactly the opposite view and they're totally right. And we just continue to do that. It's really very predatory and very manipulative. And if I said to you, describe democracy, I don't think you'd say centralized, autocratic, surveillance-based. You know what I mean? The tech we have right now is awesome if you're an autocrat. It's awesome for China that makes no bones about, surveilling its people and so forth. But America, it's like the tech is not a trivial thing that we use once in a while. We are connected to this technology 24/7, right? Whether we like it or not. And I'm not, I talk to people and they say, well, it's not me. I'm not on social media. It's not just social media. The same model is used for shopping and for search and for everything. And we're now connected to the so-called Internet of Things. So even our refrigerator,
Alexa, or whatever it is.
Everything that, you know, your Ring camera, your Nest, the thing that's watching your baby, Siri, Alexa, and all that. And by the way, we've all learned that all that stuff has been scraped. So now our voice can be replicated perfectly. And so now that can be weaponized too. Our image can be replicated perfectly. So that can be weaponized too. And so we're entering this next phase of generative artificial intelligence, which is, and by the way, algorithms are machine learning. That's artificial intelligence. You know what I mean? It's a fancy marketing term, right? Of the same model, aggregate the data, right? In this case, they're called large language models, train it so that it spits out stuff. How does it work? You train it and you ask a question and it predicts the next word and then the next phrase and then the next sentence and then the next paragraph, right? That's how it works. Sometimes it looks like, well, that's pretty smart. Sometimes it completely hallucinates and it's like ridiculous. It's completely wrong. It's just predicting, just the same way the current model is predicting how you're going to react to something I feed you, right? A news feed or information. So it's the same architecture or design, just a much more powerful version. And why on earth would we take something broken and make it more powerful? Wouldn't we fix it? Doesn't logic say fix it first? And then
that makes a lot of sense, but we're driven by the wrong things.
And we're continually being fed. Yeah, we're all kind of, you know, a professor at MIT had a great quote. He said, "We're all living in a minimum security prison. We just don't know it."
Wow. When you think about the future without any sort of revamp or disruption, if we continue down the road that we're going on, I mean, you talk about divided country, threats to democracy, echo chambers of hate and anger, talk about children's suicide rates going up. I mean, obviously, like, these people are super impressionable, like, after, you know, before a certain age and even after a certain age, a lot of negative. But if we don't fix it, in your opinion, what happens?
The country will look nothing like it looks now. And what I love about America and democracy generally, and I loved about growing up, and I love about learning and getting, and getting educated, it's all going to look very, very different. I mean, as I said earlier, I don't know how you have a democracy with surveillance-based, just, this invasive, exploitive technology that is autocratic, because it is the reason I chose Thomas Paine as my inspiration in the book was, he in 1775 asked his fellow colonists at the time, before the United States of America existed, he boiled it all down to a simple choice. He said, "Do you want to continue to be a subject of a king, a monarch, or do you want to be a citizen?" And, you can be a citizen if you want, meaning you can have rights. You can, what we later started calling unalienable rights. You're born, in other words, with the same rights as the king. Did you know that? You can have those rights. We can be self-governed. We can create a government. We don't need a king. We can govern ourselves. You can own things, property, etc. Just a pretty revolutionary idea. And thankfully, our forebears chose citizenship, and the country, the greatest country in the world, in history, was created. And to me, it's very saddening that 250 years later, we're sitting here having this conversation, and because we are actually giving up those rights, those hard-fought and won rights, to use the internet. It's wrong. We should be digital citizens, not digital subjects. And so why would we ever, you know, as I say, give up these rights just to use a piece of technology that we can design to actually embrace those rights and make them even stronger? What does digital 2.0 look like with a great, you know, democracy 2.0 look like with a great trusted internet? I think it would be pretty awesome. What does the pursuit of knowledge look like if we have collective genius, meaning everybody really
data.
Yeah, participating, and you're not, you know, it's not just a cesspool of information, you know, totally
gated,
contaminated
as well.
Sorry?
It's not gated.
Yeah, exactly. It's open. And look, when I grew up, I got to make mistakes. I made a lot of them, and they were forgiven and forgotten. And now, if you make a mistake as a young person, that mistake is there forever if it's online. And in many of those mistakes are being used to harass kids and bully them and so forth. You know, we've all met bullies growing up, right? Maybe one off or this or that. But being attacked by 1,000 or hundreds of, you know, bullies when you're a little kid, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're vulnerable, when you don't realize that mistakes are forgivable and forgettable, and you think it's like too big a mistake, I'm gonna take my life now because I'll never be able to make it up. I have a young daughter who was in school, and she, one of her friends was sitting next to her and wrote a little note being a little critical of the teacher, of what she was saying or something, and handed it to my daughter. And she scribbled something like, yeah, I agree, or something, you know, just being, trying to be a friend, you know. And the teacher saw them passing notes, so she said, what's on that paper? And then she saw it was something about her. And she said, well, you're going to have to go to the principal's office. And of course, my daughter came home saying, I have to go to the principal's office. Am I going to be expelled from the school and this and that? I don't even know why I wrote it. And the teacher, you know, was trying to give them a lesson, right, about respect and also just, you know, what's proper and what's not. So they went to the principal's office, and the principal said, okay, you know, you're forgiven, and go, you know, apologize to your teacher. And of course they did, and my little daughter apologized, and the teacher gave her a big giant hug, and she came home relieved. Okay, she had made a mistake, she had learned her lesson, and the piece of paper was thrown in the trash, right? She learned, it's over, life goes on. If you do that same thing on, you know, you do something that you regret, because my daughter said to me, I don't know why I did it. I said, honey, you did it because you wanted to be friends with that little girl next to you, and you thought that was, at the moment, that was the way to be friends. But if you now make mistakes online, and you're a young person, that you can't make mistakes, right? You're not, and it's just, we're stealing childhood away from people, right? I mean, how is it possible to steal a childhood away from a child? It's, so this is really just taking everything we love, or at least I love, and we're kind of giving it up to use it in kind of an awesome tool. You know, we went through the history. It's a pretty epic what was created, and now everybody can be connected to it. But it should be designed with us in charge of us. We need to own ourselves again. I don't want the Chinese Communist Party owning me, and I don't want five big platforms in the U.S. owning me. I want to own me. And I would expect that you probably want to own you too.
Definitely. When you look at what you're doing with Project Liberty, the solution in its most simplest form is DSNP. Can you just describe the solution, what DSNP is, how it works, some of the things that you're building in that ecosystem, so people can understand sort of like the light at the end of the tunnel?
So DSNP, it stands for a decentralized social networking protocol. And the social is not social as in social media. The social is as in social graph. And the D is for decentralized. Okay, that's probably the key thing to focus on. So we want to re-decentralize the internet. And it's again, a relatively, when I say simple, I want to be careful, it's very sophisticated concept. But relative to people changing their habits and migrating to, you know, kind of a new protocol, I think that will be the more challenging part. I think that the tech is relatively easy in that sense. But I have so much admiration for the technologists who created it. And by the way, it was very interesting when the first time I heard about it, for me, it was a light bulb went off. It was a real aha moment. And I said, like, this is a really, really novel idea to create a global social graph that would be universally accessible. We'd all own and control our data. And it would be something that, if adopted at scale, would completely change how the internet works, because it would put us in charge. So you'd be returning agency to individuals. And we'd still have the network effect, by the way, would be part of the internet. So anybody building a new app in this new world would get the network effect theoretically, but with permission, not because they scraped your data and they're in the privileged spot of having all the data, right? So it would feel much more, I don't know, much less invasive, and we'd feel much more in control. So I was immediately knew it was the right way. And I said to Braxton Woodham, who was the gentleman who runs our labs group and I was talking to, I said, go out and find out who's doing something like this, because I want to work with them and accelerate this. And he came back to me a few weeks later and said, nobody. And I said, well, then we need to do it. And can you pull together a team to create a protocol, create the whole stack, you know, a wireframe version of the stack, so that we know it's worked? Because before I open my mouth, I want to know it works and it's not just a concept. And he said, yeah, given the resources, I can. And I said, okay, I'll get back to you. And in December of 2019, greenlit the project. And we were at a company outing at the Statue of Liberty Island in New York Harbor. And when I caught up to Braxton to tell him the project was a go, the Statue of Liberty was right outside the window. You know, it was a great moment. And so the next day, when he copied me on the email to the team he was assembling to do the project, it was the email said RE, Project Liberty. And so it is just stuck. And so off they went to, you know, issue a white paper and then release the spec and then start building on it. And it is a protocol combined with a layer one chain that gives individuals power and control. And so now you have an identity when you're on the internet. You're discoverable without having to go through any of the big platforms. As I say, the data is stored in a shared state, and it's not hackable because it's not sitting in a single location. It's decentralized as well, and your data is portable. As I said earlier, the apps are interoperable, and it is a far, far better design for the for an intranet that would suit and meet the original purposes of a decentralized communication system, and would meet and support democracy, and would give us now a shot to return integrity and truth and trust to the internet, so that facts would matter again. And it would, most importantly, as a father of seven children, I'm concerned about the impact on not just my kids, but all kids. And so it would start, you know, giving us a shot to really create a tool that was actually healthy and gave these kids back their childhood.
So if people want, they can go to ourbiggestfight.com. I think that's where they get the book. That's where you start to go into this rabbit hole of this movement that you're creating. And they go down that rabbit hole, they go to projectliberty.com, if I'm not mistaken. And then they can see all the work you do, probably some of the apps that are, do you call them apps? I don't know if you call them apps, but some of the projects that are being built in this ecosystem.
Yeah, the first use case to come onto DSNP was a Web2 social media app with 20 million users by the name of MeWe. Yeah. And MeWe, those 20 million users are moving over to DSNP now. There's 700 700,000 of them have migrated, and the rest are coming. And that's just one app, you know, and there'll be 9 million, 10 million apps in this new world, just like there are 9 million apps in the existing internet. And you imagine now with all these new apps operating the way I've described and being interoperable, we have a whole new ball game. This is a Cambrian effect of growth and opportunity. The wealth that can be shared now in a data sharing economy, and the things that can be done to solve problems when you've restored integrity to the internet, and just us having control of us again, and actually say designing the future we want, not being dragged into one by these machines, is, you know, I think very exhilarating, and it really makes me very enthusiastic. You mentioned ourbiggestfight.com would be the place I would ask your listeners to go. I wouldn't call it a rabbit hole. I would actually say whatever the opposite is that gets you going up into the sky into a new, because I do.
Stairway to Heaven.
Because I do feel right now we're all kind of living in a cave and just don't realize that if we just looked up, there's a hole in the roof of the cave, and all we have to do is climb out of that hole, and there's a whole world out there that we can go find if we do this. So I see this as really a stairway to something very, very positive. So ourbiggestfight.com will take you throughout the, you know, Project Liberty and dsmp.org and all the stuff, but all you need to know is ourbiggestfight.com, and then you can go wherever you want, share your comments with us, join the fight. That's the most important thing. Right now, what we need to do is to get a conversation going. And that, because we do need, as you say, this to become a campaign that people feel like, you know what? I'm gonna dedicate some of my precious time to this, because I too am concerned about the problem. I don't think you and I are the only ones seeing and feeling the problem out there. I think millions of people are, and I think this is a way for us to get excited about, like I said earlier, this is our Man on the Moon project. So I hope people take a few hours of their lives and read the book, and share with me and with the Project Liberty team what they think, because we just want to get it right. It's not my biggest fight, it's our biggest fight, and we just want to get it right. And if it means we have to change something or support some other idea, we're going to change it and we're going to support it, because this is about fixing the internet and then doing it correctly this time, so that we can really have an awesome tool for technology, and a tool of technology rather than something that is doing so much harm.
Very quickly, just the last thought to pull out of this. If people read this and you want them to walk away with one thought, one idea, one big picture, what would that thing be?
We can fix this. This is very doable. Because the one piece of, you know, 3 years ago when, 4 years ago when I talked to people about this, honestly, many of them were just, the eyes would kind of glaze over, because it was, people didn't see the harms. And it was like, yeah, this is good, but what I have now is good enough. Now people are seeing the harms. The zeitgeist has changed. And so now when I talk to people, most of them say, this is terrific, but is it possible? Because we're kind of stuck into the paradigm we have now. I want people to know it's possible. I want people to feel it's possible. And I know it is. And this is how change happens, right? You put forward, you capture people's imagination about what's possible. And we need to get out of the cave and see that there's lots of possibilities here. We don't need to be taken advantage of by this technology. We don't need to be a product and dehumanized. We should own us, and we can design and create the future we want. And so if they take from the book the sense of possibility and not just, you know, fantasy, but I mean, we can do this. We can fix this mess, and it can be awesome once we fix it.
Frank, thank you. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for Project Liberty. Thank you for taking this on. It's a lot of work, but you're going to do it.
Well,
do it.
We're going to do it.
We're going to do it.